Sarah C.
And I'm Sarah D. You're listening to the Art Attack Podcast.
Each episode, we tackle a new work of art in Washington, D.C.
We hope our podcast encourages you to look at art in a new way.
When it comes to art, we're serious.
As an art attack.
So we just had an art attack field trip extracurricular activity about the Ai Weiwei piece that we just posted about. And it so happened that the E Street Cinema is showing a film about Ai Weiwei called Never Sorry. And we're going to talk about it a little bit more because I think that it made me think slightly differently about his piece that we just did and or have some more insights into it. So
yeah, absolutely. The whole time I was like, ooh, I wish we'd seen this before we talked about it. But actually, I'm sort of glad that we did the piece first and then saw this because I feel like, a lot of the stuff that we said was very on target. We were very astute. Mm-hmm. Yay, us.
Yay, we're so smart.
But it did give like a deeper insight, definitely.
Yeah. One thing that we both kind of reflected on was that how integrated his art and his activism and his life all kind of are. That they are just, it sort of organically seems to flow. Like his activism and his art are all, there's not much distinction between them.
Yes. He's a very prolific tweeter and he likes to do interviews. He's all over the press, which is interesting because I think a lot of artists don't like to do that. You know, I think he's very different in that way. And this film sort of takes place over like 2009, 2010, 2011. So it's interesting to see sort of a whole arc of time in his life and how he responds to things. And when he decides to go online and, like, post about stuff.
Yeah, which is pretty much all the time.
Which is pretty much all the time, yes.
I mean, it really did kind of seem like he had been just waiting for these to come about since, like, the 80s.
Yeah.
But he was like, okay, internet, let's go.
Internet and portable, handheld, like, personal computer devices that also make phone calls. Mm-hmm. Yes, called smartphones.
Yeah, because he just walked around and took photographs all the time. Yeah. Now he has a format where he can post them and make them available immediately.
Yeah.
Everybody's walking around and documenting stuff, and there was one scene where there's sort of a standoff with a couple of police officers, and the police officer is standing with a camera filming Ai Weiwei, and Ai Weiwei's videographer is with the camera filming the policeman.
Yeah.
And there's a part where they're just both standing there filming each other.
It was really funny, actually.
It creates like an infinite loop of some kind.
Of filming.
That is like, but the thing that Ai Weiwei was sort of reflecting on was the fact that the use of the film and of the footage was going to be so different between how the police would use it internally and then how they were going to be transparent and make it available for everybody.
Right, and put it online. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, was the sort of underlying current about this movie was that for Weiwei, transparency is the biggest thing. Like, the more things are out in the open and the more things are have light shined on them, the freer and more open society is. And that China will never truly be a free society as long as things are hidden in the dark. And he tries to do that with his project about the earthquake victims, right? And, like, bringing to life the names and trying to find out exactly who died in this earthquake. And at one point, someone even says, the government should be doing this. I is doing this, but the government should be doing this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I thought was just heartbreaking, you know?
I know. That was an insight for me, I think, a little bit into the piece that we did into Fragments. Was sort of a little bit of understanding more about the ethos of why he created it. And actually seeing the vases that he had painted over or broken. There were, like, Qing Dynasty vases, and I would break them or paint over them or paint the Coca-Cola logo on these ancient vases. It's not because he's saying this is garbage or because he doesn't value it. It's because that's what the Chinese government is doing.
Right.
But nobody cares, or nobody says much about it. When the government does it, it's almost expected.
Right.
When he does it, people talk about it and think about it.
Yeah, that was a fascinating part, that, like, he's just sort of making this larger commentary and understanding that this is part of what happens, you know? Things get destroyed all the time, and right, his doing it is a statement. Which I also thought, you know, when you said earlier just about how his life online was so important, politics and his life are so important. Like, it just seemed like his everyday living, breathing self is just a political being. And I thought that was really fascinating.
Yeah. I was trying to think about why it works so well with him and his particular way that he goes about it. And I think it's because he's so playful about it. He's not preachy.
Yeah.
He's really having fun with it and trying to be sort of childlike and have other people, like he has a party instead of a protest.
Yeah.
It makes it a much more approachable kind of message. Even when he's talking about very serious things and making very, very serious statements, I think it makes it more listenable.
Right. He always has a twinkle in his eye, almost, when he does things. Mm-hmm. Or putting the middle finger up at Tiananmen Square, you know? I mean, that's like, there's a tongue in the cheek, but it's also serious, you know?
Yeah. So it just makes it more digestible, I think.
Yeah.
And it's not that sort of, like, very preachy artist. Like, Yoko Ono has that very, very preachy feeling where you're like, shut up.
Right.
I don't care, right. Yoko Ono. With him here, you care because he's just being, I don't know, that's part of probably like his personality, just that playfulness.
As you said in the podcast, that it, the idea that it's just sometimes with some artists an expression of ego, and with Ai Weiwei, it's not ego. It's totally about the things around him and him responding to those things, as opposed to being like, look at me being so responsive to these things, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
He cares a lot about the stuff that he's critiquing, and it shows, but you're right, he does it in a way that gets people on board with him. Mm-hmm. And you could see the response and the reaction from ordinary Chinese citizens, you know, who he's at a restaurant and people stop and just say, I know who you are and I think you're amazing.
He's the rabbi.
He is the rabbi.
They even call him teacher.
Yeah.
Teacher I. Or, yeah.
Yeah. He is the rabbi. Yeah. It's interesting also, so it's not about his ego, but there's definitely a cult of an artist personality, right? Mm. Like, he freely admits that he doesn't make everything, you know, he contributes in some ways, you see him contributing to some things, but he has the idea, he is a true conceptual artist, he has the idea and other people execute it. Mm-hmm. He even says at one point, they want to ask his mother what she thinks about him, he's like, go find any mother and tell her, ask them about her son, and then you can replace that name with my name. And that's an art piece, you know? It, like, that was an art piece happening as he said it. I was like, that's awesome.
Yeah. I liked that quote, the one that we were, that quote that we were like, oh, that's our new, like, slogan, is that life is more interesting if you make an effort.
Yeah.
I think that was something like that.
That was a good, he said something about just replace art with life, and that's our ethos. Art is more interesting if you make an effort.
So you kind of wonder, like, he's going through all this stuff and being arrested and going through all this crap and having his expression sort of stifled, you kind of wonder, like, well, why doesn't he come to New York? Or why doesn't he move to Germany? Or go to some place where...
Or London.
Or, yeah, where his art is clearly embraced and appreciated. And I think that is because he feels so much, you know, love for the, you know, Chinese people and commitment to making that country a more open and transparent place.
Yeah, I agree. That's a good... I didn't think about that, but that's a really good point. That he stays because he knows that there's work to be done, you know? He knows that that he can't really rest. I don't think he could live abroad and live with himself, you know, that if he wasn't pushing back. The fact that he goes back to the police station where he was assaulted every year on the anniversary to file a complaint. And he says, you know, like, if you don't complain, if you don't make them go through the process, nothing will change, you know? Mm-hmm. That was really profound.
Yeah. And you can't just, you can't talk about how the government is oppressive based on your, like, assumptions. Like, you have to go through the process and show how it's oppressive.
Right.
You can't just complain about it being oppressive without, you know, just in an abstract way.
Right. Now you have something to say, like, look, they're stymieing me in my attempts to file a complaint.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was fascinating that he So he lived in New York from, like, what was it, 83 to 90-something.
Yeah, 90.
It was, like, 12 years or something, yeah. And that the two biggest influences on him living in New York were the Iran-Contra affair, you know, hearings.
The hearings, yeah.
And thank you. Uh-huh. And Tiananmen Square. Mm-hmm. And watching those two things on television in America and seeing a government going after one of its own and having that televised and being open and asking probing questions, mm-hmm. right? And asking Oliver North, did you lie to Congress and all that stuff?
Yeah.
And then seeing people at home in China speaking out, standing up to the government. You know, those two factors. And Tiananmen Square I totally got, and it wasn't until this movie that the Iran-Contra made, that makes total sense to me, mm-hmm. you know? But those were fascinating examples.
Yeah, having the contrast, he said that once you've had a chance to experience freedom, that it's something that stays with you, it stays under your skin.
Yeah.
And that motivates him. And that the example of Iran-Contra, it's seeing how the process functions not in a perfect society, but in a flawed society. And how does the society deal with it when the government is in error and is, you know, commits criminal acts or, you know, that ability to be transparent and to have these hearings in a public forum is what is, like, that process is lacking in China. Not that nothing ever goes wrong, but, like, what happens after something does go wrong.
Right. In stark contrast to the earthquake of 2008. It was also just interesting. I think we both felt this sort of like jolt of like seeing art being created, seeing him have the process of it. Like, it's just a fascinating, he's such a good spokesman for like art. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. For living art, if that makes sense.
He's like an artivist.
Yeah! Ooh!
An activist artist.
Snap.
Yes.
Yes. That is profound. I like that. No, that's awesome. Yeah. He totally is. Yeah.
Everybody should be an artivist.
And everyone should be an artivist, yeah. I think I said in the podcast, like, if you're not making art that isn't saying something, then why are you making art? Mm-hmm. Like, make something that pushes people's boundaries. Make something that makes people question their whole existence. Make something that throws into, you know, all of people's assumptions into chaos.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like right now. Go
right,
do it.
Exactly. Go do it. Or go to a museum and go appreciate someone who's doing that.
Do something. Life is more interesting if you make a little effort, people.
Put something out there. Yeah.
Yeah.
In the spirit of Ai Weiwei.
Yay.
Yeah.